On Environment and Natural Resources will come to order. First bill on the agenda is Senate File 3365, Senator Kubley.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Senate File 3365 is a land transfer bill from the Department of Natural Resources to the County of Chippewa. You do have an amendment there, Mr. Chair. It's the A1 amendment. If someone would be willing to move the amendment, I'd appreciate that.
Chairman, I'll move the amendment.
They just were passing it out, so we didn't care.
Sure, it's tax forfeited land, but not state. Okay. All it does is it converts it to the county.
Okay, Senator Fredrickson will move the A1 author's amendment. Yes. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment's adopted. Senator Kubley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. With me today are one of the Chippewa County Commissioners, Jim Dolvang, and our County Administrator, Scott, I forgot.
Williams.
Okay. I knew that, too. But anyway, I'd like to give them a chance to talk to the committee for a minute, if that's agreeable.
All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Jim Dolvang, Chippewa County Commissioner. In 97, after our flood, that's when Chippewa County got this property. It's approximately 30 acres, and our plan has been all along to make it a regional park. And there's three parcels that are owned by the state that we need to acquire to have it for the park. And let's start talking.
Mr. Chair, members, there is a map in your packets, I believe.
You wouldn't mind introducing yourself for the record?
Scott Williams, Zoning Administrator, Chippewa County. The three parcels of land that are tax forfeited total approximately 2 acres. They're completely surrounded by, your maps are black and white, I believe, so you can't see the boundary, but what looks like a trail all the way around the outside is all Chippewa County property with the exception of these three parcels.
We don't have a map here.
Oh, I see one here.
I don't see it in our packet.
It's page three of your county letter.
It's in the packet where with the letter from the county commissioner. Okay, thank you. Sorry for the interruption.
Sorry. So those three parcels total approximately 2 acres. We've been in contact with the DNR Lands in New Ulm, and they are supportive of our project and are preparing a letter for the legislature with the review. So once acquired, we would move ahead with development of our park on this property.
This is going to be a county regional park.
Correct.
Okay. All right.
Chairman.
Senator Fredrickson.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Williams, could you tell us where this property is located? I know it's along the Minnesota River. Falls of Montevideo.
It's between Granite Falls and Montevideo on the river, about 5 miles south of Montevideo. Highway 212 is just off your map to the left.
We do have a bicycle trail that goes from Montevideo to Wagdell as well, so that'll enhance the trail as well.
Okay. Fredrickson?
Mr. Chairman, I'd move that Senate File 3365 as amended be recommended to pass and sent to the floor.
Senator Fredrickson, we're going to lay this over for inclusion in the lands bill, which we're taking up a little bit later in the agenda. So we'll just lay this over for inclusion in that bill, and so it'll be part of the big lands bill.
Inclusion.
Chairman, that would be fine, or I would amend my motion to lay it on the table for inclusion in the lands bill.
All right. We don't need to vote on that. I'll just lay it over if there are any other questions. Any other questions on Senate File 3365? Seeing none, Senate File 3365 will be laid over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Lands Bill.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Senator,
appreciate
Cooley.
Your time.
Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. Next bill on the agenda is Senate File 3393, Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I do have an A2 amendment.
Pass that out.
I'm pretty busy.
Okay, this is an author's amendment.
Chairman, I'll move the author's amendment.
Senator Frederickson will move the A2. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
Motion prevails. Amendment's adopted. Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, this bill deals with a potential Midtown Eco Energy power plant that is proposed to be built in the East Phillips neighborhood of my district. The people in my district are very much opposed to this plant being located there, and in addition to just generally being opposed to it, they have a lot of concern about the level of emissions that this plant would create in addition to the things that they already are experiencing. Let me just mention some of those things. First of all, this neighborhood is an arsenic Superfund site. Arsenic has been found in excess levels in the yards due to a previous plant that was operating there in regard to arsenic that was in various types of fertilizers that were being dispensed on the railroad lines through that neighborhood. The second thing is that there are a number of other things that are already there that do contribute to some degree of air pollution. There's an asphalt plant, a foundry. There is a roofing hot asphalt storage site. It is the future site of the city's hot asphalt storage as well. And in addition to that, because of the proximity to freeways and other roads that have a lot of traffic on them, there also is a high amount of lead contamination in the homes and yards of the people in that community. I have a handout for you. I don't know if it's been passed out or not.
It has.
It indicates that this wood burner would be distributing into the air quite a lot of various chemicals that we know are not good for people to be breathing. And we know, in addition to all of the other problems that the East Phillips neighborhood has, that the neighborhood has been determined to be one of the most polluted locations in the 5-county metro area, and this project would bring major hazardous pollutants that do not exist there today. 40% of the population of this neighborhood are children, and 40% of them live in poverty. These children have a disproportionate share of asthma and other chronic health problems, many of which could be related to toxins in the area. We believe that this project should not be allowed to move forward by giving it permits, and so that is the major reason that I am here today. I do have a number of people here to testify in relationship to this bill, some of whom are from the neighborhood. I'm not sure if Dr. Greaves is here yet. I know. Is Dr. Greaves here? Why don't we ask him to come up then, because he could not, he has a limited amount of time that he can be here.
Okay. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
Yes, my name is Dr. Ian Greaves. I am an occupational environmental medicine specialist. I am a faculty member at the University of Minnesota School of Public Health in the Division of Environmental Health Sciences. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Senator Berglund, thank you for asking me to speak briefly to you today. The issue, as I see it in terms of environmental policy, is one of what has come to be known as environmental justice. When we have impoverished neighborhoods that have a disproportionate burden of environmental health problems, the federal government has recognized this, and indeed the state government and the MPCA have recognized that this is an environmentally unfair situation, and the MPCA does indeed have a policy on environmental justice, and it contains three main elements. The policy is designed to ensure that minority and economically disadvantaged communities in Minnesota do not bear a disproportionate share of the involuntary risks and consequences of environmental pollution. Secondly, that they are not denied equal access to environmental benefits. And thirdly, that they have opportunities for meaningful participation in the development and implementation of Minnesota's environmental programs. I think in regard to the first of these points, that they do not bear a disproportionate share of involuntary risk is really the issue here. How do we assess risk in terms of involuntary risks? One way is to look at things facility by facility, as seems to be happening in this case. Another is to look at the total burden faced by the population affected. And I don't think there's any question that the population affected here has a disproportionate burden of identifiable environmental health problems, especially in children and the elderly, the sick, and women who stay at home of childbearing age. These are all highly vulnerable populations represented substantially within this particular neighborhood. The additional burden of pollution that may be offered by this facility would be on top of, as Senator Berglund has said, a number of heavily polluting industries that that liberate substantial quantities of agents that we know to be toxic. What we need here is a cumulative assessment for this neighborhood. It's already suffered a lot of environmental deprivation over the years. Its citizens have expressed that in terms of their adverse health effects, especially in children. And to add an additional burden without assessing the cumulative effect of existing burdens would seem to be an unfair imposition on this community. At least they deserve to be assessed in terms of what that additional burden might be. And I think that's the thrust of this bill, is to ensure that they do not have additional burden, and that the PCA has some processes in place to follow through on its existing environmental justice policy. And I thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the time that you've allowed me here, and I'd be very willing to answer any questions.
Questions for the witness? Thank you, Dr. Greaves.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, yes, I have Carol Pass, who is president of the East Phillips Improvement Coalition.
We ran all the way here. Thank you so much for the opportunity to speak, Mr. Chair and the rest of you. I'm coming as the president of the neighborhood, and with regard to the
Ms. Path, would you mind introducing yourself for the
record? Oh, I'm sorry. I thought I did. I forgot my name. Carol Pass. I'm the president of the East Phillips neighborhood. I live at 2536 18th Avenue South in Minneapolis. And I'd like to address the environmental justice issue with respect to the ability of the community to participate in this decision as far as it's gone. And I have to say that the document that we got from the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency that really allows us to respond only became available to the public, as far as I could find, on November 2007. By then, almost all the permitting, almost all the assessment, almost all the public meetings had been held. Only a few people came. They occurred on the night of our main public meeting. We had only a few people there. Finally, we canceled everything and got there. But the last meeting where we finally got there was after all of the public hearings. Basically, this was sort of a move to get the last one in there. It wasn't part of the venue. I really think that the community has not had sufficient information given to them. I just want to call your attention to the air emission risk analysis on page. Well, it's on 139 in the big computer generated book, but it's actually a part of the first of the 15 pages of the environmental risk analysis. And this, just to respond to the public policy issue, this was done, the analysis was done, finished at on February 2007. We didn't even know this had resurfaced as an issue at that time. And it says here the MPCA is not aware of any specific community concerns at this time. The risk manager's decision came from that. There is an approval here signed by several people, and it was done on the basis of February 2007 analysis. At that time, I don't believe anybody in the community had really heard about this. And this is deeply disturbing, given the fact that I can look here and say the farmer cancer risk rate is above the threshold for this particular facility. I raised this issue. I'll try to go quickly. I raised this issue with the senior engineer for this project, and I said, well, we have children playing with their hands in the dirt. They're out all day long. They put their hands in their mouths. That's how we end up with lead retardation. We have people living very close, numbers of children. Doesn't this sort of move it toward the cancer risk threshold? She said, I suppose it does. And I said, then we have multiple stacks. Do you look at the other stacks? The one stack is above the cancer risk threshold for farmers. What about the other two or three? If you add these all up, they may be right at the cancer risk threshold for everybody. And then we have the kids playing outside. And I said, this seems to me to be a classic case of environmental justice. What can I do, or what do you do? What trips this? She said, I don't know. I said, but you must know. Somebody must know. Give me some guidance. She said, I can't. I'm repeating this exactly. She said, I can't. I said, I find this very disturbing. I said, thank you for your candor, but I'm very distressed by this fact, because as a president of the neighborhood, I simply can't sit there and deal with that. So I'm running all around trying to find some way to deal with this. We came here because there seems to be no way. She mentioned legislation, but she's got this wonderful policy that talks about minorities and et cetera. And it's unimplementable, I guess. I don't know. But I guess what we need is something that allows us to, at least in this case, respond. Because the MPCA, given, I won't bore you with all of these details, but basically we didn't know. Little Earth was never even approached on this subject at all. The Metro Urban Indian Directors never heard this tale. And it wasn't until I called the MPCA and realized that we have no way to protect ourselves. And so we're asking you to do that, please.
Thank you.
I'd like to call on Bill Ziegler and Jay Bad Heart Bull.
Good Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bill Ziegler. I am president and CEO of Little Earth of United Tribes. You've heard some of the statistics about the East Hills community. One statistic that totally sets Minneapolis and Minnesota apart from any other city or state is the fact that it is home to the only urban Indian housing community in the nation with preference in housing. I'm sure that if any of you all have read the papers in the past, you've probably heard the tales about Little Earth and some of the issues that the community has faced over the years around crime and violence and social issues. One of the things that I'm here to talk about, however, is the reawakening that we've had within our community over the past 3 years. The fact that within our community we have seen a marked increase in grade point averages of our kids and attendance rate in school of our children. Another thing that I think sets us apart within our community is the fact that we have had a 45% reduction in crime over the past 2 years within our community. Little Earth is home to about 1,000 people, 60% of which are under the age of 18. We have this huge reawakening going on within our community. Really, the way I like to view it is a look in the mirror. We've come to a point within our community and as a people that we do understand that if we want a better future for our people and for our community, then we need to take the initiative, stand up and take that and make things better for our own community. You hear it said all the time that the children are the future. We have to provide for a better future for our children. One thing that we understand in our community is that if we expect a better future, then we need to provide a better today. And we are doing just that. The things that we can control, we're controlling. The changes we can make, we're making. One thing that's very frustrating for me as the president of the organization, however, is that when we're doing all that we can to change the direction of our community, that there's things that happen, decisions are made that are totally beyond our control that have such a huge health impact on our children. I was talking with a young grandmother within our community last week, and I was shocked to hear her say that in her generation, she had never heard of asthma. Folks in her generation never had asthma within the Indian community. Now, almost every single one of her grandchildren has asthma. And I just find it hard to believe that there's not an environmental factor that's causing this to happen within our community. I think statistics speak for themselves in regards to the health of the American Indian people, the type 2 diabetes epidemic, and all the different issues that we're facing. What I'm here to ask is for your assistance, that while we're, as a people, we're standing up, we're making the changes necessary within our community, that I'm asking for your assistance to help watch out and make decisions on the issues that we don't control. Thank you.
Thank you.
My name's Jay Thomas Badhartbull, and as a community worker in South Minneapolis, I find it paramount that the work that I'm promoting with health education and nutrition and physical education with our youth, specifically American Indian youth, we need to provide an environment that's conducive to overall well-being, and it's really important that we combat a lot of the socioeconomic factors that are stacked against our people in the community. And I would like to have work on writing grants and programs that really speak to getting our children educated in the community through physical education, through nutrition, and this really dovetails into the importance of our children being provided a more healthy environment that we put them in these positions, and they'll play next to a nuclear power plant if we tell them to, but that's not good for them. What we need to do is allow them the freedom to really grow in a healthy environment. So thank you for listening.
Thank you.
Are we on this one?
Yeah.
Senator, your next witness.
Mr. Chairman, that completes the testimony that we have for you today.
Okay.
I guess we do have one more person.
Okay.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Please join us and introduce yourself for the record.
My name is Deborah Terrain. I work for EJAM, Environmental Justice Advocates of Minnesota. I'd like to go on record as saying we oppose the adding of another burner to this community. Thank you.
All right.
Copies of a map of Hennepin County here that shows where the Phillips neighborhood is located and what the hospitalizations are as a result of arsenic and asthma per 10,000 people.
Senator, do wood burners emit benzene, styrene, and all these other chemicals you have listed?
Yes.
All right. Next on the list, we have Kim Havey, Midtown Echo Energy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have some brief handouts for the committee members at all.
All right, we'll pass those out.
Members of the Senate Environment and Natural Resources Committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today on Senate File 3293. My name is Kim Havey, and I serve as principal for the Kandi Ohi Development Partners, which is currently developing the Midtown Eco Energy Project. As a resident of Minnesota for 19 years, I've been an advocate for economic development and sustainable environmental projects like Midtown Eco Energy. The Midtown Eco Energy Project provides an immediate opportunity to harness innovation and take action to create local, balanced, renewable energy solution that supports neighborhood economies and the global environment. In spring of 2006, Kandi Ohi Development Partners responded to a request for proposals from the City of Minneapolis to build and develop a combined heat and power facility in the Phillips neighborhood, and we were awarded through that RFP process site control. From that point on, we have worked tirelessly to put together a project that is in line with the direction this body, the governor's office, and the public have requested for renewable energy. This Senate file before you would create an unnecessary barrier to the implementation of Midtown Eco Energy. There are currently processes in place through existing local and state regulatory organizations to permit, regulate, and oversee projects such as Midtown Eco Energy. My message to you today is this. Projects like this are the future, and we are on the leading edge of change. Please avoid creating regulatory hurdles that may jeopardize this and every other unique and forward-looking project on renewable energy. There are many positive aspects about Midtown Eco Energy, and I want to underscore a few points today. This project will provide renewable electric energy and district heating in Minneapolis while reducing our carbon footprint and the current level of emissions from energy production. Our cutting-edge emissions control systems drastically reduce the impact of local energy production. The project will help Minnesota meet the renewable energy portfolio standards, generating electricity for approximately 18,000 households and heat for over 2 million square feet of commercial and office space. The partnership behind Midtown Eco Energy is comprised of local leaders in business and environmental policy with more than 50 years of experience working for positive change in Minnesota. We are dedicated to setting a renewable energy example and building the local green economy. The facility will create 20 permanent new jobs in the neighborhood at an average annual salary of $63,000, as well as up to 200 union construction jobs over an 18-month period. With this level of economic benefit and policy achievement, this facility will help jumpstart the green economy in Minnesota. Throughout the life of the project, we have worked closely with the MPCA and the City of Minneapolis to ensure that all environmental impacts are carefully assessed. We have participated in two community meeting processes for the air permit, and we have worked on an environmental assessment worksheet, which will provide the best information to permit decision makers and the public about the project. We have received three unanimous votes of support from the Minneapolis City Council since responding to the RFP. The Minneapolis Planning Commission unanimously supported the conditional use permit as well. This project is sited in an industrial zone that has allowed this type of use since 1924. The regulatory barriers proposed in this file will do little to enhance our understanding of cumulative impacts or serve to protect Minnesotans. The MPCA has developed and is already implementing a highly effective regulatory system for scrutinizing the impacts of new energy development projects in Minnesota. We have been in the process of an air permit environmental review since December of 2006. The air quality standard that was set by the MPCA is that this facility must have equal to or lower emissions than any other similar permitted biomass-fueled facility in the United States. Let's be clear. This regulation would slow economic development throughout Minnesota, effectively putting a stop to the issuance of air permits for similar facilities. If you would not support this type of policy statewide, it is unfair to single out one project for special regulatory requirements and for Midtown Eco Energy to be scrutinized by an entirely different set of criteria that was not established prior to the application for a permit. In these times of financial belt tightening, it makes no sense to develop a problem in search of a solution at the taxpayer's expense. The regulatory system in place now is working, and there's not a need for a major overhaul. This project has been carefully and thoughtfully undertaken and is financed primarily by local investors. We are in compliance with the City of Minneapolis zoning and other regulatory requirements, and we continue to share up-to-date information with local constituencies and collaborate with them whenever possible. We have undertaken review of the environmental justice impacts of this project and do not believe that environmental justice concerns are well-founded. We will continue an open dialogue with all stakeholders to get the facts out about the project throughout its development. The project is ready to go this year. It requires no state or city subsidies, yet will provide millions of dollars of new revenue to local and state government and a $2.5 million annual payroll to Minnesota residents. Candy Ojai Development Partners is a small company established in 2005 to develop renewable energy in Minnesota. Midtown Eco Energy is our first renewable energy project, and we have been working on it for 2.5 years and have spent over $1 million of private money to develop the technology, secure the site, secure the wood fuel contracts, raise the capital, and develop a viable financial plan that can make this project a reality this year. Midtown Eco Energy can make a real difference in our local, state, and national green economy, can help lead the world into a sustainable energy production future. Senate File 3293 could bring this important redevelopment project to a halt, put a stop to future renewable energy projects in Minnesota, and set back progress towards the Minnesota Renewable Energy Portfolio Standards and the redevelopment of the Phillips neighborhood. Senators, we have done what you have asked us. We brought forward a carbon-neutral, baseload renewable energy project to Minnesota. We did it with local talent, local capital, and through a 100% Minnesota-based company. We are proud of the Midtown Eco Energy Project, and with your support today to defeat this Senate file, you can be proud of as well. You have a difficult decision to make based on a few minutes of testimony, and I hope that not all projects like this will need to come before a committee in order to decide their fate after the time and money has been spent over the last 2 years. You have a difficult decision to make, and we ask you to make a decision to support our project, to support renewable energy in Minnesota, and to say no to this selective enhanced regulatory barrier that would do nothing to improve the understanding of the issues related to our project. Thank you very much, and I'd be available to answer any questions.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sir, could you... We've got a lot of maps here of Hennepin County and the Phillips neighborhood. Could you give us any idea of where in that neighborhood that your project is located? And could you also, there's a sheet that we have about all kinds of emissions that would be coming from this. Can you clarify what kinds of emission control systems are a part of this? And does this accurately reflect what you expect the emissions to include?
Mr. Haley. Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, I'm joined here actually by Libby Henderson, who is with Wank Associates, who is an environmental consultant, and she would be able to answer the questions related to those specific control systems that we do have in place. We are also, just to respond to your first question, we're located at 28th and Hiawatha, approximately in an industrial zone just to the west of Hiawatha, near Hiawatha and Lake Street. And it's an existing building that's now used as a garbage transfer station. And it's a very unique building. As you see, we have a picture of it renovating a 1939 WPA-built facility and adding all the new technology to it in order to utilize energy.
Mr. Chairman, before the other question, what's the source of the material that you're going to be burning? Is that local?
Yes, it's local wood waste. We have a contract for all the city park systems wood waste, which in 2004 would have generated nearly 100% of the fuel needed for the project. Excuse me. We have contracted for and have two sites for our exclusive use. One is on the north side of Minneapolis, one is on the south side to process the wood fuel, and that wood fuel would then be brought to the facility. We have about 2 to 3 days of storage and silos of the wood waste on site.
Senator Bergling, you were pointing to a map.
Right, so you have this map. the Phillips neighborhood is this little part here. It's blown up here, and this facility would be located approximately here.
In the northeast corner of this, of the neighborhood?
Yes.
Roughly?
Northeast?
Okay. Mr. Chair, I would just a correction on that. I believe it would actually be the southeast corner of the Phillips neighborhood.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Four cents.
All right. If you have an answer to the environmental question, please introduce yourself.
I can try to answer that. My name is Libby Henderson. I'm a consulting environmental engineer. I'm wearing multiple hats today. I'm also on your list to speak as a citizen. I prepared the permit application documents for the Midtown project, and I can speak to the question. My main comment on the handout that was given you on the list is that I could come up with a list like this for just about any facility in the state, and I could pick scary numbers and present them to you. I could make a longer list, and I could get you bigger numbers. Just go on the EPA TRI website, go on the MPCA's website. It's easy to come up with stuff like this. Just because you don't see it every day doesn't mean it doesn't exist. Any kind of wood combustion will create emissions in the form of volatile organics like benzene and styrene and carbon tetrachloride, and most kinds of combustion will even make those. You just don't see them quantified on a day-to-day basis, so they look scary to you. I'm used to dealing with them on a day-to-day basis. Every project that I deal with has numbers like this. I could come up with a nice, scary set of numbers for you that look like this on just about any facility in the state, and you could find them too. I think you have a TRI item on your agenda later in this meeting even, and that would be one fun place to look for some of this stuff. Some combustion sources are exempt from TRI, so you won't find as much combustion stuff there, but that's a whole nother discussion. I don't know if that addresses the general overview, the technology, the control technology that will be applied in this case. It's a fluidized bed boiler, which is the best kind of boiler technology for good combustion of any kind of solid fuel. The way that you control volatile organic compounds is really at the combustion time. Basically, when you burn a carbon-based fuel, your purpose in life when doing that is to make CO2. That's your plan. And what you want to do is take all the carbon into energy, and when you do that, you're making CO2. This is a carbon-neutral project because the source of that carbon is actually plant material that has a very short life cycle, and in the end, all that energy comes from the sun. So you could say this is solar. You could say it about coal too. It's just got 10 to 100,000 years behind it instead of a much shorter time frame. But this begs the question I've been toying with personally about writing some essays about combustion to educate the general public, because I feel like we're all coming from all these different places on how much we know about this. But anyway, so the control of the creation of intermediate organics, which is a lot of what you're seeing there, is done by trying to have the best combustion possible in the unit. And the fluidized bed technology will do that in this case. They'll do the best they can. The any metals or other particulates are controlled by a fabric filter device afterwards, which is, again, the best available control device that you have for particulates, and it's also the best you have for fine particulates. It does the best job of any kind of particulate control for fine particulates, which has been raised as an issue. So the proposed unit is definitely state-of-the-art and has the best available controls on it. That was part of the permit process.
So the numbers that were listed here are before or after the controls are in place?
Those are after. Those numbers are like, we went through a few loops with the MPCA on settling on those numbers. My original numbers were lower, and I believe that the actual numbers will be lower. The MPCA was not comfortable with the data set that I used, and it basically required me to use higher numbers, and I believe those numbers represent what you were given. So there's not a 100% agreement on what the numbers will be, but the PCA assessed it at the higher level.
Senator Bergelin and then Senator Dibble.
Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to add one other thing, and that is while this land is zoned commercial, industrial, it is just a block and a half away from homes. I mean, there are homes all around where this would be located. So, you know, to say that it's going to be in a commercial industrial zone does not protect the residents of the area from this type of air pollution.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted the developers to have an opportunity to respond more specifically to what these numbers mean, because they look big and scary, and I think we're struggling with what is the right thing to do. On the one hand, we have folks from Little Earth and folks in the neighborhood who say, A, they haven't had a chance to respond to this. They didn't know about it. I'm wondering what the story is there. How much involvement and knowledge has the neighborhood had. Secondly, I serve on the Energy Committee. We serve on the Environment Committee. We hear biomass is good, and now we're hearing it's bad. Maybe these numbers can, we can understand these numbers better in context. It is hard to understand these numbers. They look big. They look scary. I do know that. I've heard arguments on both sides. The argument on the other side I've heard is that the traffic, that this wood has to be hauled to the site, so there's concern about the truck traffic and the mobile source pollution that represents. But on the other hand, there's a lot of traffic to that site now. I hear there are fuel oil burners that will be taken offline at nearby hospitals. They'll now be heated with steam heat. Is that true? Will that be a net benefit to the neighborhood? This will represent energy that doesn't otherwise have to be generated by coal. Granted, that's up in Sherburn County or some other place like that. But does that get factored in? So I'm just hoping to understand, trying to do the right thing, hoping to understand this biomass burner in context.
Mr. Havey, who will this serve, and how does it compare?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, this project will serve about 18,000 households, or a little over 10% of the city of Minneapolis's electric needs. Currently, 97% of that power in Minneapolis is coming from coal and from nuclear. Yes, it's a little farther away, but to give you a relative example, coal has 80 times the amount of sulfur dioxide that wood does. So even if you use the most state-of-the-art wet scrubber and remove 95% of the sulfur dioxide when using coal as a fuel, it'll still be four times the amount per BTU of energy of an open, uncontrolled burn of wood. This is true in all the different cases in relationship with the type of fuel that's used. There's always going to be implications that you have to look at in regards to the production of energy. This facility is 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, providing base load energy. So it's a great complement to wind energy or solar energy. Wind only produces energy about 35% of the time, and solar probably less than that. And so this is a good complement to other forms of renewable energy. I encourage you to look at plan. There was a article in Finance and Commerce that showed Opus, one of the largest real estate developers in the state, is planning to build a $200 million residential hotel office complex immediately adjacent to St. Paul District Energy. St. Paul District Energy in downtown St. Paul is 1.5 times the size of our facility in total amount of fuel used. It is also immediately adjacent to the Science Museum. I don't think that Opus would plan to buy from Ramsey County that land to develop this type of facility if it was dangerous facility or hazardous to the occupants of their building. You also have probably heard of
that facility burns wood.
Burns wood as well as it has the ability to burn coal, Senator. And one other point to make is that in Virginia and Hibbing, they also have coal. They have a coal facility that was converted to a biomass wood facility. Both of those are located immediately downtown. The Virginia facility, which is a similar size, a little bit smaller, is located immediately adjacent to Virginia Public High School. If the MPCA or the residents of Virginia or the representatives and senators of that area felt that this was hazardous to their health, I don't think that they would have gotten a permit. The reality is we are lower emission per BTU than either one of the plants that are in existence today. We meet all of the state's current regulatory regulatory limits that have been put on. We've agreed to work through a process through the environmental assessment worksheet, which this facility has such low emissions, it does not require an environmental assessment worksheet. We did one voluntarily to look at things such as cumulative impacts and other things to assess the truck traffic. We are going to be moving forward with the project, hopefully, and with that, we'd be providing district energy to Midtown Exchange, Abbott Northwestern Hospital, and to Children's Hospital. That's over 2 million square feet of hospital and commercial space. It is a lower-cost alternative to them. They are no longer going to be using natural gas, and in some cases, they use fuel oil, but those will then go on standby. So we'll be providing that kind of energy as well to the community. And so, again, you need to put the relative emissions in context here. When we're looking at Sherbourne County we don't see that right here and now, but somebody is, you know, having to deal with those emissions. We don't see what has to happen in Prairie Island. It's not here right in, you know, the front yard of the Capitol, but somebody has to deal with that spent nuclear waste storage. So what we're doing is bringing in renewable energy to where there is a demand. It's called distributive generation. We do not need to transmit this over long distances. There's a tremendous amount of loss of energy when transmitting power. And the grid manager, MISO, Midwest Independent System Operator, has indicated there is no ability to transmit any additional wind power from Buffalo Ridge until at least 2013. Until the CapEx transmission lines are in. So the reality is that the only way to bring new renewable energy into Minneapolis and St. Paul is to build it within the existing distribution grid within the cities. This is the most efficient distribution of energy. It's the most effective to do it. I also ask you to take a look at the article that was written about Viksjö, Sweden, the 2007 European Union's Greenest City on the Continent Award. And what the second paragraph says is the reason they received this EU Green City of the Year award in their first year, this is the inaugural year, it was 2007, was a result of a biomass combined heat and power facility just like ours. So this is a preferred strategy under the International Energy Agency to address climate change. It is referenced as achieving goals of the Kyoto Protocol. It is considered to be a carbon neutral on the European Union's Carbon Cap and Trade Program. It meets the state of Minnesota's renewable portfolio standards for renewable energy. And so we feel we have done a very good job of bringing the best possible project forward, and the resulting energy that's produced is going to be very beneficial to the area and the community.
What's your response to the public input concern that was raised?
Mr. Chair, we initiated discussions about this project years ago and have done many, many community meetings. And up until, about January of this year, we had unanimous support of the local neighborhood organization. As a matter of fact, Carol Pass wrote a letter stating that she was thrilled to have this type of facility be part of the future green economy of the Phillips neighborhood. The information that is available through the air permitting components of it that the MPCA made available, we talked about it. There's nothing. We went to numerous community meetings. I don't know the exact number, but in excess of 20 for sure, and have been doing that and have been requesting, you know, opportunities to talk with anyone who would like to speak with us. So we've been very out there in the community and talking to people about this project.
The meetings were in the Phillips neighborhood.
We met in the Phillips neighborhood. We've met in Longfellow neighborhood. We met in the Corcoran neighborhood and the Seward neighborhood and various other areas around there. The reason being is the four different neighborhoods come together at the intersection of Hiawatha and Lake, which is only about two blocks from where our facility is located.
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to ask Dr. Greaves and Carol Pass to come back up here to respond to this information that you're being given. And while they do that, I'd just like to remind the members of the committee that this facility might have some benefit for the state, it doesn't benefit this neighborhood where it's going to be located based on the emissions that are going to be generated. The MPCA in its own document calls the emissions hazardous. And so, you know, obviously there might be a place where it could be sited where you wouldn't have as many other environmental factors going on as you do in this neighborhood. So if I could call Carol Pass and Dr. Greaves up.
We have one more person that wanted to testify, a Boyce Jones from the Urban Isle Corporation. Is that person here?
Yes, he is.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then we'll certainly give you an opportunity to respond, Senator Berglund. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Boyce Jones. Currently, I'm the CEO of Urban Isles Consulting, who works in environmental justice, GIS, public policy, and environmental justice. I think I may have said that, and economic development. I'm actually here at this table because I actually believe that this is a good project, and I'd just like to, if I could, just give a few comments about why I think it's a good project. If I may submit to the record.
We'll pass that out.
What actually brings me to this table personally is in 1996, as a student at California State University, Chico, in the planning department, I wrote my thesis on alternative energy delivery systems and the role of the planner. Some people think at that time I was reading tea leaves, but obviously 10 years later, it's pretty apparent that I was on the right track. I think the information I'm submitting to you just will kind of reflect how I actually got here. It's not because I am such in support of the project in the Phillips community more than I am in support of alternative energy delivery systems and their role in Minnesota and the future of its desire to bring its greenhouse gas emissions under control. I also had the opportunity to work on the Minnesota Governor's Climate Change Advisory Group. While working on that group, we had created renewable energy standards, which I think also this particular project plays a great deal and has a great role to play. One, in the fact that it's one of the first projects that we're doing two things. One, we're creating green jobs, which is very important in the neighborhood and the communities that I work in. And second, it's saying to investors that indeed, if you do want to become involved in bringing these greenhouse gases under control, and you're willing to make an investment, and you're willing to follow the guidelines, again, that the rest of the state will be looking at this particular project. I am personally looking at this project because I'm also in discussions with a number of people in the White Earth area, indigenous groups, who are interested in wind energy. And I've been, of course, advocating that they basically, if they had the courage and the ability to invest in it, to do so. So, of course, the amount of adversity that is involved in creating such projects, I think, is very important to this project. I mean, is will be seen in this project as well. We want to know how to do it. And yes, I'm sorry, Ms. Senator.
Oh, no, I'm sorry.
Go ahead and finish your remarks. Okay. We'll take questions.
Thank you.
Afterwards.
And again, all this is just kind of just giving you an idea of what actually brought me to this table. I do believe that if we have people who are willing to make investments, not just in alternative energy delivery systems, but to also do them with the kinds of, I think, care and concern as far as environmental justice is concerned, then we may have a very arduous process, but in the end, I think it's going to be a good project. So again, I'm here not to say that this is a good project or a bad project for the neighborhood or community, but to talk about what I think are the attributes, not just for the neighborhood, but the sign that we're actually sending, that it's very important that if indeed this particular project is going to be a seminal project, that's going to say that if you want to invest, you want to make a difference, here's a process that you must go through in order to achieve that. Lastly, I have had an opportunity to speak to a number of people, which I'm hoping will be reflected in kind of the information that I have before you. I attended in Louisiana, in New Orleans this weekend, the Equity Summit, of which I was able to raise these particular issues to people like Dr. Robert Bullard, what we consider the godfather of environmental justice. And one of the things that in my discussions that I was able to determine is that there needs to be a discussion about how we can literally make sure that we got sustainable development and that it is also aligned with the types and kinds of commitment to environmental justice. And we will have to work with corporations and companies in the future if we're going to achieve any kind of balance as it relates to both sustainability and economic development. And I would be open to any questions. Thank you.
Okay. Senator Saxon, did you have a question?
Mr. Chair, I didn't know this witness, but I do have a question I want to get.
Senator Berglund?
Mr. Chairman, I wondered if Mr. Boise Jones could disclose what his relationship is to this development.
Oh, absolutely. Jones. Absolutely. I approached Candy Ojai after there was such a groundswell of support. Well, there was a groundswell of support for the project, and all of a sudden I can't explain it anything else, but a groundswell of support against it. It just kind of happened overnight. And again, as a person who's since 96 been advocating for these kinds of projects, I approached him and asked what could I do to help to see this project happen. So as a consultant, I agreed that I would try to work with them to try to mitigate both the conditions that the EJ community, of which I am considered part of that tribe, and the development community, of which I also work in development as well. So as a consultant, not as a person who represents the environmental justice community, I approach them to assist them.
Thank you. Senator Paulson Jen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't know if Mr. Boyce, if you could... Mr. Jones, it is.
Yes.
Anyone else there. Do you ever consider, when you think about our weather patterns and the prevailing winds are generally from the southwest to west to northwest, depending on the season, it seemed to me that the Phillips neighborhood would have the least impact of any area on the whatever is coming out of the stack.
I think I can address that for you. As part of the, this is Libby Henderson again, as part of the air permitting analysis, the MPCA has rather strict criteria for determining the impacts, and that includes meteorological assessment. So any effect of the local meteorological impact is taken into account.
So, Mr. Chairman, so what did they determine?
It's that the meteorological data goes into the assessments of the impacts, and those were discussed previously. Carol Pass talked to them a little bit. So, in other words, when they figure out what the cancer risk is, for instance, the meteorological data is part of that analysis. Does that am I getting closer to answering your question? I'm not sure.
Well, Mr. Chairman, is there any relative impact in terms of areas?
I don't know that I understand your question. Sorry.
Anybody watching a weather map and knowing which direction storms come and the prevailing winds tend to be from the south and west, and in the wintertime where it's more northwest. Well, this is located at the very southeast point. If you think of the way the winds are coming, it's not the direction of any smokestack stuff is going to be going anywhere but to the Phillips neighborhood, with maybe the exception of a few times when we might have an east wind.
The assessment has to look at both a very short-term and a long-term impact. So on a short-term basis, there can be impacts that are local. In other words, you have a particular wind pattern that's not an annual, what you're thinking of is more on an annual average over, you know, some months of the year it's mostly from here and then it's mostly from there. The short-term numbers look at very short-term individual events. The longer-term annual average numbers will take that into account. And the impacts, what the assessment finds is where the maximum is, and the maximum is in the Phillips area. Is that?
Senator Berglund.
And Mr. Chairman, if you look at what happened with the materials that contained arsenic, they were located in that same part of the neighborhood, and they had the major impact in the Phillips neighborhood because of wind blowing that stuff into the air and landing in people's yards.
Okay. Senator Saxoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Does the MPCA have any opinion on what's happening here?
We'll bring them up.
Okay.
Senator Berglund, did you want to bring up your rebuttal last, or do you want to do it now? Why don't we give you the final, you and your witnesses,
all
the
right,
final word. Senator,
Mr. Chairman,
would DCA like to approach? And Senator Fredrickson?
Mr. Chairman, could I ask Ms. Henderson an additional question about smokestack and deposition?
You promise you do it loud enough so I can hear you.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Henderson, kind of a follow-up to Senator Olson's question. I'm assuming that this facility will be emitting water vapor and other things through a smokestack. And how high is that smokestack, and how closely to the plant will some of those emissions be reaching the ground?
Sanderson?
There is a stack. I think we settled on 130 feet.
140 feet.
Okay. And it's on the site. So it will be adjacent to the existing building. There will also be cooling towers, so you will see a water plume from the cooling towers, and you'll see a steam plume, especially in the winter, from the stack itself. And again, the assessment that, and I want to comment a little bit on some of Senator Dibble's questions earlier. Midtown and Kandi Ohi conducted the assessment that was required by the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency to determine the health risk. And they did what the PCA asked them to, according to all the PCA's policies. And the one of the misnomer or difficult issues here is that the neighborhood people are picking up on the farmer number. That implies a scenario that does not exist in this area. The farmer number that the PCA uses assumes that somebody is actually growing all their crops to eat and to feed to a cow that they would then milk and drink the milk from or slaughter and eat. That is not happening in that area. The PCA's assessment, alternate version of the assessment, is for a residential neighborhood, and their residential numbers do include community gardens. They told us that. And that is how they proceeded to approve the project prior to some of the concerns that were raised. So as far as I'm concerned, I mean, the company set out to do what the PCA asked them to do. They followed all the policies. They did all the assessments. And the residential assessment was acceptable. I also want to say really quickly that if there is a problem in Phillips, it's my understanding, I used to work at the PCA, worked there until 1993, and I did one of the original, finished up one of the original urban air toxics analyses. And then, as continues to be true today, that if there's a problem, typically in an urban area, it's from cars and area sources. It's from mobile sources and from what they call area sources, which would be dry cleaners, gas stations, home heating, wood fireplaces. So stopping this, if there's a problem in Phillips, stopping this project won't fix it. The state today does not have jurisdiction over mobile sources, and the PCA does not have jurisdiction to go and stop people from burning wood at their houses or to stop people from building gas stations. So if there's a problem, this ain't going to fix it. You may want to ask the PCA to develop a methodology to fix it, but this isn't going to be it. So that's that comes from my 28 years of working in environmental pollution control. 23 of those years have been in air quality, and eight of that at the PCA, and then the rest of it outside consulting. So, and I diverged significantly, and I don't know if I answered your question. I apologize.
Mr. Chairman, I'll try and ask the question one more way. You have a 140-foot tall smokestack. You have emissions coming out of that smokestack. Suppose there's a 10-knot northwest wind. Where will those emissions hit the ground?
What was determined was where the maximum impact was, and it was nearby the facility, and I don't have a map available with me right now. It was the closest residential areas to it are to the west and north, and I believe it was fairly close to the facility where the maximum was. So I'd have to run a particular individual look for a particular wind speed, but the maximum impacts were in the neighborhood, and those were assessed, and in the residential scenario, they were acceptable.
Mr. Jones, then we need to go to the PCA.
Sorry.
Thank you. I'd just like to add as a caveat, you know, there's this axiom that says if the only tool you have is a hammer, you're constantly in search of a nail. And I found that to be apropos in this case. In my 5 years of working in environmental justice issues, one of the things that I have found, in essence, is that a great deal of the majority of issues that people see are relevant, but not necessarily environmental justice issues. As it relates to this particular case, I spent a few years also working on the arsenic triangle in the Phillips community with various other environmental justice groups. And those issues are very real, and I don't want to marginalize them whatsoever as I sit here. One would seem that I would be almost conflicted, if you will, being kind of on both sides of this, an advocacy for the project, but at the same time, an advocate for the environmental justice group. I like to say that I'm not conflicted. I think what in the end will happen is that because of this rigor, both sides will win. That in essence, that by making certain that the accountability measures are in place, that the project project should be a very good project. And at the same time, that the environmental justice community should also be not appeased, but satisfied that we looked at every particular hole to be plugged in order to come out with a good project. I think I liken it to the guy, the work that you guys do. He says, well, you know, like making laws. You really don't want to know, you know, what goes into doing it. I think, but in the end, there generally comes out this very good project because of the rigor. So I'm not stating that there should not be rigors associated with this particular development, nor the passing of it. What I think should happen, though, it should be a very fair process in order to make certain that everyone's going to win. What the only problem that brought me to this table is when I heard we must stop it. And I don't know how we can reconcile inviting people to invest in alternative new energy systems if what we're saying to them is not in my backyard. If we have a mandate to do so, especially, again, by the state, I know the question was asked, well, what good is it for the Phillips community? I mean, based upon what I'm hearing is that there would have to be a moratorium on development across the board in Phillips, based upon the conjecture that's coming out of the rhetoric. So I'm only simply saying, in essence, that there be, one, a fair process for Kandi Ojai, because I think that these are not the big guys. I sat on, again, this committee this summer, 8 months. I wasn't a paid person for 8 months. That means that I was there to do the work on behalf of people in my neighborhood and community. And in that 8 months, I learned that Big Stone 2 and Masaba were both coming online. Two coal-fired plants, of which I worked very rigorously to get converted to natural gas, Riverside and St. Paul. Now, what's the problem there? Very clearly, they're going to, on the record, spew more mercury, spew more GHG. No one's saying, let's stop those guys. Why? Because they're major, you know, power companies with a great deal of resources. But the small groups who are trying to at least show that we want to be involved, we want to make a difference, we want to have an impact, that's where the groundswell of opposition is coming from. And lastly, when I met with the MPCA a few weeks ago, one of the things that came out of that meeting is that they said that they had more phone calls about this project than any other. Now, again, seeming conflicted, I was both very happy because, you know, look at the EJ community, you know, en masse, they had responded to this project. Well, I figured that we had come a long way to have that kind of energy toward being able to address their issues. But again, at the same time, no one seems to be putting that kind of energy toward Masaba and Big Stone 2. So again, I'm trying to reconcile, what's the yardstick? What's the guidelines that we're actually using here?
Thank you, Mr. Jones. PCA, want to comment? Welcome.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, David Thornton. I'm Assistant Commissioner at the Pollution Control Agency. Well, the bill, as amended before you, pretty much takes us out of the loop. It just says in this area we can't issue a permit. So we had more trouble with the bill before it was amended. I do have some questions about perhaps unintended consequences of this. And for example, I believe that we permit the boilers at Abbott Northwestern Hospital, and I'm concerned that the language in the bill would prevent us from reissuing their permits or from amending their permits if they wanted to change them. I don't know what other facilities are located in this neighborhood that might be impacted by that as well. There's been a lot said about that one could take as decisions that have already been made by the PCA, and just to fill you in on where we are in the process, we're still conducting our review of the facility. We have not made any decisions. We haven't issued a permit. We are in the process of completing the environmental assessment worksheet. The first big decision that gets made then as to whether or not that is adequate for making a decision on the permit or whether an environmental impact statement is needed. And that'll come later this spring. I'm sure it'll be made by our citizens board. because of the nature of this issue that's been very controversial. As Mr. Jones said, we've received, I think, more comments on this project than any we've ever had, and that's interesting. So should you not pass the bill, the next step would be a decision on the environmental assessment worksheet, a question of whether to do an environmental impact statement, and then ultimately a question of the permit. But we haven't made any final decisions yet.
What's your anticipation on an EIS?
I wouldn't want to prejudge that, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you. Ms. Thornton, are you able to answer my earlier question? Is this a lot or a little of these chemicals? Does the PCA consider the net effect, you know, traffic to the site, the boilers at the hospitals? I think that's what people who are on this committee or energy committee, when we're considering other kinds of biomass types of facilities, are struggling with. Are we tipping this neighborhood over the brink
Mr.
of acceptability?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dibble, one of the elements of the environmental assessment that's currently underway is a cumulative air analysis of all sources of air pollution that are affecting this neighborhood, the vicinity of this facility. So that will be taken into account, mobile source emissions, emissions from nearby facilities, background air quality conditions. We do that because of a Minnesota Supreme Court decision that was made in 06. The citizens advocating responsible development versus Kandiyohi County, it's called the CARD decision, and it spelled out the need for us to do a cumulative analysis as a part of environmental review. This is a small facility, fairly small facility. Its emissions were low enough that it was not required under state regulation to conduct an environmental assessment worksheet. The company, after citizens expressed a great deal of concern, decided that, and with our recommendation, that an environmental review process was probably the best thing to do to try to answer the questions that were being raised. And that's why we're in environmental review for this facility right now.
Okay. You, Senator Scogin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Thornton, you mentioned that you said it's a small facility, its emissions did not require the study. Is that typical of a facility this size, or is it because this facility is equipped to produce less emissions?
Mr. Thornton.
I think the answer to both of your questions would be yes. It has to do with the size of the facility and the controls that they're employing. The threshold for requirement of an environmental assessment worksheet is annual emissions of 250 tons of pollutants. And this will be lower than that. That's why it wasn't initially required.
Follow up, are there facilities this size that produce more than that?
Mr. Thornton.
I don't know offhand the answer to the question. There are larger projects around the state, obviously. As you heard already, District Energy and downtown St. Paul is a larger facility.
Senator Berglund, do you want to conduct your response?
We have to produce power someplace. It has to be in some of these backyards.
I'm supposed to go first. My name is Carol Pass again. I'm the president of East Phillips Improvement Coalition, the neighborhood organization that would be a host to this, or to this facility. First of all, I want to say that I don't believe this bill or our intention is to oppose industrial development in Phillips or South Minneapolis, or to oppose all biomass facilities everywhere. This is not our intention. I think that probably there is a place and good use for those things. I don't want to have such sweeping statements made about our concerns. Why did we end up, and many people ended up, supporting this initially? Clean Water Action supported it. They pulled out. Our neighborhood supported it. The other neighborhoods, surrounding neighborhoods, are now very concerned about this, and some of them have pulled their names off the Good Neighbor Agreement. The Good Neighbor Agreement, though, really only gives us a tour and a conversation. It doesn't really allow us a chair on this, and there's no requirement that they inform us of what's happening. And so, really, we pulled our name. We went on it in the first place because, well, I'll tell you, I went to the Community Advisory Committee on the Environment for the mayor and city council. And I heard the presentation again. It was the same presentation we initially heard at our neighborhood. The people in the area were never mentioned. You could imagine that it was happening on a desert island. There was no additional pollution mentioned. We have a seriously challenged neighborhood with regard to health. And I made a joke about seeing polar bears and worrying about the polar bears in the North Pole and not the people right here. And I was shocked that that's the way I felt when I heard this presentation. The people, the problems, the additional pollution were never a part of it. Many people signed on because many people do believe that biomass is one of the ways of the future. But our concern is the people here now. They were ignored in every one of these presentations. There are ads, expensive ads, all over Minneapolis calling on people to call the city council and pass this. Never are the problems of East Phillips, of the Phillips neighborhood, mentioned. Never is mentioned the asphalt plant, the foundry, the Superfund site, the hot tar storage, and the coming city asphalt hot storage in this exact same area. We have serious problems already, and this isn't an objection to this technology. All of this talk about this technology is, in a way, irrelevant. We know that it's above the farmer cancer risk rate. And the senior engineer told me that when I described the children playing in the dirt all day long, never take vacations, they don't have the money to leave the area, and they are right underneath it. Little Earth is right there where you described the Northwest plume going. I'm here to speak with regard to these people. Many of them don't speak English. And I they're of every color of the rainbow and every ethnicity. But they have, it's not in my backyard. The issue is our backyard is full. Will somebody else please share this issue? Because we are very full. We don't have any more space in our backyard for this. And that's the issue. The issue is the people. And the issue is that apparently, according to Paula Connell, the senior engineer, this moves toward the farmer cancer risk rate. That's everything that I told her about the way the people live there, she said that herself. And she also said that she had no advice for me and that she didn't know what trips the environmental justice policy. She said that. She said, I don't know how we... She said, I've asked all around the office as to how to bring that to bear on this problem. And basically, I have to say I was deeply alarmed, and I think all of you should be deeply alarmed because these could go in anywhere. This is not an objection to this technology. It's not an objection to locally owned. But I need to comment. Locally owned is not the people in Phillips. It's people that live around Lake of the Isles who have a great deal of money and can make a great deal of money off of this facility. And so the local people will not benefit, will only get increased challenges. And one last thing I want to say is that the Green Institute started looking at this initially. They determined not to proceed ahead with it because they determined that there was not enough wood supply. Everybody is competing over the clean wood supply, District Energy, Rock 10, and everybody. And whether the ash borer comes floating into town and devours half our trees. They're not the size of the elm trees, and there is not enough wood. When you invest almost $100 million in a facility and it's needing to heat everything, you're going to have to burn something or you can't pay your loan. What will you burn? That's one big issue. There are a number of issues here that haven't even arisen and really need to. I just think this needs full examination, and frankly, one last thing. I'm sorry, but this document that says, it says on the second page, this facility will be a major source of hazardous air pollution. It only appears in this one big fat thing, which appeared on November 2007. And ironically, it says on the front, not open for public comment. This is the only thing worth commenting about. I mean, you know, there's some political issues here and some economic issues and some ethical issues that really need to be in focus here. This, again, is not an objection to this technology, but it's our backyard is full, and we did not have this in hand when our neighborhood organization got this big thing, and I read it through about 10 times, and we really put together this whole thing. We have some good PhDs over there as well as a lot of people who don't speak English, and we analyzed this, and we realized that we had said yes to something that is very dangerous for our community, primarily because we are overloaded, and we did not know this when we said yes. And many people said yes, and they are now saying no. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bill Ziegler, Little Earth. I wish we would have had the opportunity to say yes or no. We learned about this a month ago, is when Little Earth first learned about this. And maybe I should apologize to you. I can't speak as elegantly as some of the folks that have been up here, and maybe it's because English is not my first language, but my Lakota language is what I learned first. You know, sitting here listening to all this makes me think of a couple things. Number one, I guess I no longer fault as much my ancestors for losing our land. There's some really good words were spun here today. So I need to apologize for not being able to speak as elegantly as some of the folks here. One thing to understand is that Native people are the original stewards of the land. We're the original environmentalists. I'm not opposed to geothermal plants. Before I moved to Minnesota 3 years ago, in South Dakota, I was my tribe's energy planning director, researching just these things of producing energy in a better way. And obviously there's a cost to everything. And I think that as a community, we're not willing to sacrifice our children to save polar bears or anything else. I think it's a very simple, I guess, question on at what cost. There was a discussion about a hammer, you know, and it was inferred that we were a community wielding hammer looking for a nail. I got to tell y'all, we feel like a nail. And there's a hammer being wielded, and every time something needs to happen, we get hit. We're not opposed necessarily to geothermal power or to green energy. What we're opposed to is the fact that we continually have to bear the brunt of the environmental fallout from this type of production. That's it.
Thank you.
Again, my name is Dr. Ian Greaves, University of Minnesota. I'd like to respond to some of the technical data. The numbers quoted for emissions are not huge, but they're not trivial either. Taken on their own, one would say they're moderately polluting or moderately to highly polluting, especially in the area of particles. And we know that particles have significant serious health effects, including sudden death in people who have pre-existing heart or lung disease. The ultra-fine particles that come from high-temperature combustion are particularly prevalent, and I think one estimate puts it at about 25 to 30% of the ultra-fine particles in this neighborhood would come from this facility. That's a significant burden. This facility also has sources of exposure that are not airborne. So looking at multiple airborne exposures is not necessarily going to quantify all of their risk, such as to arsenic and lead. And this community has significant arsenic and lead problems, which may be exacerbated by additional airborne exposures. The vehicular sources of exposure are significant and would be added to by this proposal. Again, I'm not opposed to biomass as such. My issue with the proposal here is that it adds a substantial burden to an already environmentally burdened group. And the risk assessment that I think the PCA needs to do is not just a multiple apportionment of air sources, but a multiple apportionment to all sources, no matter what the route of entry into the body. In that way, we'll capture some of the important issues that are present in this neighborhood and which have contributed significant disease and disability to children and other individuals in the neighborhood. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Senator Berglund, your final comments?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I would just ask you to approve this bill. Clearly, the community that I represent is very, very adamantly against this. Organization after organization has withdrawn their support. And I think that we need to recognize that when they are asking us not to continue to do things that make their situation worse, we need to listen to them and we need to respond. We have a lot of low-income children who do not have a choice of where they live. They live where they live because they are low-income children. And they do not have control over the property they live on oftentimes because it is rental property. And so adding this burden to this community at this time would be the wrong thing to do, and so I ask you to support the bill.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Berglund, is it possible that the neighborhood's concerns could be met through the environmental assessment worksheet, and then after that, potentially an environmental impact statement?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I think that my community feels like nobody is listening to them. They feel like this is their recourse, that here they have a way for people to listen to them. If we wait for that to take place, it'll be too late for them possibly to have the kind of input that they feel they need to have.
Senator Sieben.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Berglund, and I apologize that I was late and if I'm missing a key point here, but it's my understanding that the MPCA said that a portion or some part of this could then be possibly reviewed by their citizens board. Is that correct?
Yes, I think that was what the...
So my point then is I'd just like to encourage members to support this bill, having many people know that and from this committee remember how my community was impacted by perfluorinated chemicals, and there was a major consent agreement agreed to with the Citizens Board, which I feel very strongly that my citizens' concerns weren't heard at that Citizens Board process. So I commend all the advocates for bringing this bill to Senator Berglund and working with her on this bill, and encourage you to stick with it and try to pass this legislation as opposed to having to deal with a route of the Citizens Board, because in my community's experience, it wasn't very responsive to the needs of the community.
Senator Fredrickson?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Berglund, I've had a chance to engross the A2 amendment into the bill, and it appears to me like the amendment should also have deleted lines 19, 20, and 21. Was that what you wanted to happen? Because it did not.
Didn't it say delete everything after facility?
Yes.
But that would just delete line 18.
Okay, so...
Well, it was intended to delete that entire sentence.
Okay, Mr. Chairman.
All right. So do you want to move to amend the A2?
Mr. Chairman, I'd move to amend the previously adopted A2 amendment. After line 14 on the amendment, insert page 1, delete lines 19, 20, and 21.
Okay, that's just technical. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment's adopted. Senator Fredrickson.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Berglund, did you want this to just apply to this new facility and not possibly affect Abbott Northwestern or any other permits in the area?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Fredrickson, that is the intention.
Mr. Chairman, then I would move on page 1, line 18, in both places after the letter A, insert new. And I believe that, that would only apply to a new facility for a new permit. It would not affect those permits already in existence, like at Abbott Northwestern.
So you'd like to put insert the word new in front of facility on line 18. Do you also want to do it in front of facility on line 20?
Mr. Chairman, my motion is to amend after both places where the letter A appears on line 18, insert new.
On the amendment?
Okay. All right.
On the bill. Mr. Chairman, members, on the bill, line 18.
Which line is that in?
It's just saying, he's just amending it to say new facility so it doesn't affect any other project that PCA might have a control over.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, I'll read how that first phrase would read. On line 18 of the bill.
Okay.
It would read, after July 1, 2008, the agency may not issue a new permit to a new facility. And then go on with the amendment.
A new permit.
Okay, everyone understand the motion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion prevails. The amendment's adopted. Does this have to go to any other committee? Has there been a request?
I haven't been informed
Is. As with all bills, all policy bills in this committee, Senator Berglund, this will be laid over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill.
So it's not going on its own. Also, it's just going to be laid over?
Correct.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right. We will revert then to Senate File 2651, Senator Saxog.
Right.
Senator Saxog.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I have a subcommittee report I would like to move.
All right, Senator Saxog will move the subcommittee report. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Motion prevails. Senator
Mr.
Saxog.
Chairman.
Senator Pariso.
Sub and we have sub one.
Should be the sub
I have.
One.
It's sub one.
Sub one.
All right.
Go ahead.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Chair, members, I'd like to remove some of the language from the bill, mainly because it was included in the tax bill that was signed by the governor on Friday. And if it pleases the chair, I'd like to delete sections 4 through 9. And they deal with the Sustainable Forest Incentive Act.
Would you like to summarize those sections just so we know what's in law now?
Yes, Mr. Chair, they for the most part put a floor in the Sustainable Forest Incentive Act so that there's a minimum amount that a piece of property where the owner agrees to abide by the rules of the Sustainable Forest Incentive Act, minimum amount that they can be paid for. And that amount was set in the tax bill and does not have to be redone in this particular bill.
Okay. Does everybody understand the motion? Questions?
Could you repeat the motion, please?
The motion is to delete sections 4 through 9 because they were included in the tax bill and it's been signed, it's now law. Seeing no further discussion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment's adopted. Senator Saxon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What we have before us now is a piece of legislation that is a result of the Forest Land Consolidation Working Group that I chaired during the interim. It was under Senator Anderson's budget division. This bill, we hope, took the first step in trying to get a handle on what we consider to be one of the great threats to our forests in Minnesota, that being fragmentation, and the best ways to enhance access and management of our forests, that being consolidation. We've tried to develop a toolbox approach, and as you know, the forest legacy portion of this particular of helping with fragmentation is being taken care of in the bonding bill, hopefully, and it will also be included in the dedicated funding, the constitutional amendment, if that would happen to pass next fall. A second area we just dealt with, and that's the Sustainable Forest Incentive Act. So those two are taken care of in terms of the toolbox, and what we have left are three very important things that we'd like to review with you today. And with me, and those are going to be reviewed today. The first one has to do with the Minnesota Forest for the Future, which includes a revolving loan fund. And with me is Bob Tomlinson from the Minnesota DNR Forestry Division, who's going to briefly review those.
Welcome to committee.
Mr. Chair, members, Bob Tomlinson with the DNR Division of Forestry. Senate File Number 2651 includes a few different components here. Section 1 of the bill deals with the Minnesota Forest for the Future program. As Senator Saxon mentioned, he chaired this group that was put together several months ago and worked diligently over the summer months and then through the fall. And they basically, one of the recommendations that came out of that group is that we needed to have a little bit better overarching legislation, if you will, to help, that would be the enabling legislation and the direction that the department needed for different things, including monitoring of easements in the future. Right, in the past, the only authority really that we've had was that which was in the wording in the bonding bill that came out. So this provides a little bit more comprehensive approach to it. As it mentions in Subdivision 1, the purpose of the Minnesota Forest for the Future program is to identify and protect private working forest lands for their timber, scenic, recreational, fish and wildlife habitat, threatened and endangered species, and other cultural and environmental values. Subdivision 2 goes into the definitions that are necessary for the Minnesota Forest for the Future program. Subdivision 3 is essentially the establishment criteria for the program. And Subdivision 4 includes the eligibility criteria that we'd be looking for. Subdivision 5 is the land interest that the commissioner may acquire. In these subdivision 6 deals with the application process. Subdivision 7, there are the landowner responsibilities with it. And subdivision 8 talks about the commissioner having an advisory team to administer the program. And subdivision 9 is some correction, allows us to correct easement boundary lines. Subdivision 10 gets into the terminating or changing if we have to make changes once we've entered into an easement, the process that we go through with that. And then back on page 3 of the bill is subdivision 11, which deals with the payments. And following that is the monitoring enforcement subdivision in subdivision 12. Those are essentially the main components which we feel are more comprehensive kind of program for the Minnesota Forest for the Future program. Section 2 of the bill is a related, this is the Forest for the Future revolving account, which is essentially modeled after something that they did up in Cass County, where there would be money appropriated presumably for the purchase of pieces of property, where we would then go out, acquire those pieces of property quickly, be able to respond quickly, I think is the essence behind this. and not have to look for money through the normal bonding routes and other routes like that. But they have this revolving account come up to where we can take advantage of situations that lend themselves to us moving fast to do acquisitions, put a neat conservation easement on the piece that we might purchase, and then turn around and resell that piece of property back to the and put it back on the tax rolls. So that's essentially Section 2 of the bill.
And Mr. Chair, I think everybody has this funny green map that you haven't seen for a couple of years, but just as an example of how these easements might be used in the revolving loan fund, if you take a look at, let's say, Section 14, which is the state of Minnesota section of land, or not section, but yeah, it's a section, right?
That's right.
It's surrounded by private land. And this would not be the only instance where no access by the state of Minnesota could be technically, if Boise Cascade didn't want to give an easement, the access to the state of Minnesota's land could be cut off. So what we're talking about with a revolving loan fund is being able to purchase a portion of one of these sections from Boise Cascade, set up the easements that need to be set up to provide access to Section 14, and then sell it back to the private sector, so that we aren't necessarily buying more land, but we need to have the access to it, and these easements are important.
Senator Dill.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Saxog, or maybe one of the witnesses, how much are the easements going to cost? Per acre or per
Senator Saxauger. Mr. Tomlinson?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dill, at this point, we don't know what that would be. I suppose that would vary if we're looking, you know, we could be talking an easement for access would be different than perhaps a conservation easement where you're looking at wanting to have the land managed in a certain way. So it would all really vary by the type of easement that you'd be looking for.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dill, I think you hit on it. I mean, it's whether you're doing a permanent easement so you don't own the land, or you take the route that we were talking about here where you actually buy the land, do the easement, and then sell the land back to a landowner.
Is this basically your bill sets up a process for valuation? Is that correct? Subdivision 3 valuation of land. Is that how those things are going to be determined?
It's fictitious.
It's
Page 4. Mr. Chair, that's on Section 3, and we can move to that right now, and in Section 3, we're talking about expediting land exchanges, and Kathy Lewis from the Department of Natural Resources is going to handle that.
Mr. Chair, a question?
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, this illustration, is that just a fictitious example, or is that for real?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, no, that's Kuching County. That's one of our problems, as you can see, when we have this checkerboard of ownership. It's very hard to manage lands, and that's why we need to consolidate lands.
So Mr. Chairman, how in the world did that happen?
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, Ms. Luz is going to talk about this, but you'd like to be able to have Boise Cascade and the state of Minnesota, or the state of Minnesota and the counties, be able to exchange land on a relatively simple basis, so that in fact, they will be consolidated and will be easier to manage. This all kind of came out of the largest land exchange in the history of Minnesota, which came about up in the area where the Minnesota steel project is going on. It was 7,000 acres done between UPN Kimini, which is the Bland & Paper Company, and the county and the state. And with that experience in hand, and I can't say enough about the way the state and the counties handled that, we think we have the knowledge right now to write some rules and law that will help us to consolidate in the future.
But Mr. Chair, how in the world did you manage to do a perfect checkerboard for this kind of arrangement? Why did the state walk into that?
Well, the state's trying to create a forest, the Big Fork State Forest in the Chippewa, and you can only really acquire those parcels that are available to be sold.
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, I think that that all happened naturally. Now whether the Boise Cascade sections are the best land, so to speak, and the state lands are probably the swamp. You know, we don't know exactly what that's all about, but that's how things like that happened in the past.
Amazing.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I apologize for not being at the meeting. I probably would have got this answered in the subcommittee meeting, but two questions. I refer to number 9, owned by the United States, as having the same issue you talk about with number 14. Is that do they need to also? How do you gain access there when you're surrounded by state land? And my second question is, if you're going to sell this property, is it going to be an agreement that these people are going to, or we're going to buy the property, these people are going to actually buy it back before we do that? How does that work?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, I don't think we're, that's why you have to have options, because we don't know which way will be the best way for us to obtain easements. But and to answer specifically to your question, just because we buy it from a certain person doesn't mean it has to be sold back to them. You know, somebody else might be interested.
Further discussion, Senator Dill?
Mr. Chairman, I know you need to move on, but I just want to catch one thing here. Is this easement program, could it be considered a way to purchase development rights? I know that there are some counties back east and even close to the metro area here that have a program to buy development rights to keep open space. And so when you buy an easement or sell an easement on your land, is your idea that you're selling development rights? So you can't sell it off later on for housing or something?
Mr. Saxog.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Dill, I think that that can be two different things. We've traditionally thought of the forest legacy as where we were selling development rights on a whole chunk of land. But when we're talking about small easements that we just looked at on this little map right here, I think what we're more concerned about than development is access and being able to consolidate lands for management. So I think there may be, in some ways, there may be two different problems that we're dealing with.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dill on page 5 talks about reversionary interest, mineral and water power rights, and other reservations. So I think I don't think you're getting rid of those mineral rights completely. There's provision for reserving those rights and line 28, in exchange for Class 1 land is subject to the same trust, if any, and otherwise has the same status as the land given in exchange.
Mr. Chair, I think it would be at this point, though, helpful if Ms. Lewis reviewed Section 3, and then we go back and ask questions.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Kathy Lewis with the Lands and Minerals Division, DNR. One thing that might be helpful is to understand that this bill has combined several sections. Section 2 of the bill is not related to Section 3 of the bill, so that's a different issue. Section 3 comes from the Department of Natural Resources, and it's an expedited exchange process for land between governmental units. And particularly, this will be land exchanges between the state and the counties. Its purpose is to reduce costs for the government. It will also save time, and it will also help address the issue of forest fragmentation. So it also was an outcome from Senator Saxog's interim team meeting, too. What it does is works with the current land exchange laws. It says, what can we do to expedite the process since we're dealing with basically state land to state land or state land to other governmental land? What it does is subdivision one of the section three just identifies the purpose. Subdivision two identifies the classes of land to be covered. Class one is DNR managed land except for school and university trust land. Class two is tax forfeited land. Class three is land owned by other governmental subdivisions of the state. We've left off the trust fund lands at this point in time because we want to give this program a chance, make sure all safeguards are in place so that we can fulfill our fiduciary obligations to the trust lands. So if it works really well, we'll come back in a subsequent session and say, let's add the trust lands in. Subdivision 3 of Section 3 sets up a valuation process, and we currently have an appraisal process. We can also do a minimum valuation process. That adds in the option to do a real estate broker's analysis. Merchantable timber must be considered. Then it also provides that we have to meet the substantially value test. So if it's over 200 acres, you're within 10% of value. But once you've met that, you're done. You don't have to keep juggling acre for acre and try to figure out how do we actually equally match. Subdivision 4 requires the land to be examined. Subdivision 5 requires unanimous approval of the Land Exchange Board. That's provided for in the Constitution. It's the governor, auditor, and attorney general. Subdivision 6 is a technical provision of who goes first in issuing the deeds. Subdivision 7 has two provisions. One is a reverter provision for 40 years that says you're really acquiring this for the purpose of managing these lands. And otherwise, if you're going to try to turn around and sell these lands, they would revert to the exchange party unless they say it's okay for you to transfer them. Part B of that is recognizing the standard provisions in law for reserving water rights and water power rights and mineral rights. And subdivision 8 is just a technical provision recognizing that the land you exchange takes on the land that it was exchanged with. And that's the heart of Section 6 of the bill, new expedited process for exchanging land between units of government.
Does this bill take care of Senate File 2976? Is Senate File 26, Senate File 2976 included in this?
No, Mr. Chair, no,
different.
It isn't.
They're two separate bills?
Correct.
All right. Okay. We need to wrap it up, so is there any further discussion on the bill?
Well, we have one more quick testifier, and that's on the last section of the bill, Section 11, and that's Mr. Zavetta from the Minnesota.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is David Zumetta. I'm Executive Director of the Minnesota Forest Resources Council. I am testifying relative to Section 11, which is a $50,000 proposed appropriation, one-time appropriation in 2009. You recall that Minnesota has 16 million acres of forest land. Almost half of that's privately owned. Parcelizations rapidly occurring on those lands, those private lands, having adverse impacts on timber availability, wildlife habitat, water quality, recreational access, including hunting. This study proposes to undertake three things. First is an assessment of the trends, drivers, and effects of parcelization of forests and then subsequent development of those forests. Second, what Senator Saxog has referred to as the toolbox part of the study, is assessing the policy tools that are available to the legislature and other parties for addressing parcelization and subsequent development of forest land. And then finally, recommendations to the legislature. The governor's recommended budget in 2007 included $200,000 for this study, but the study ultimately wasn't funded. The Forest Resources Council therefore went and acquired $100,000 from the Blandon Foundation and $50,000 from Iron Range Resources. So we have $150,000 on the table. We need an additional $50,000 to make the study whole. The distribution of the funds from the Blandon Foundation and the Iron Range Resources is contingent on receiving legislative matching funds in the amount of $50,000. The governor's supplemental budget for 2008 that he just announced on Friday includes $53,000 in one-time funds to satisfy the matching requirement. Bill in front of you, Section 11, would move $50,000 forward, and that's what I was here to testify about. I'll stop there and take any questions.
Who would take questions then, Mr. Chair?
I don't see any. Senator Saxog moves that Senate File 2651 be recommended to pass and be, as amended, be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on State and Local Government.
Correct, Mr. Chair.
Further discussion on the bill. Members, we will be recessing until 6 p.m. We will, if you could maybe just, if there are important things you want to save, just make sure that they're in the packet. We will make sure that's in the packet, too, but it might be helpful if you do that as well. On the motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr.
Recess until 6 p.m.